Part 060. The rest of the weekend was a time I think we'll both remember fondly as long as we live. As long as we live. That's the rub with this war going on. Still, Mabel was right. Seize what chances we have. On Monday morning, there was just bread and jam for breakfast, some of the WI strawberry from last year that I transferred to a leftover small jar. The bread was now a bit stale, given that it had been baked on Thursday last. We'd brought tea and some powdered milk so tea was possible. Jack. This weekend has been the best time of my life. I really want to say thank you. But I feel the same. The trouble is, I'm not sure how we go on from here. He looked genuinely distressed. I think we both have to keep on with our lives for now. You doing the best you can in the police. Me with the farm. When we can, let's try to get together like this. I know that won't be easy to arrange. But until the war is over, we really can't plan a solid future. And oh, I never thought I'd think this again. I really want a future with you, Jack. He came round the table and pulled me up and gave me a long, passionate kiss. Then, without saying anything, we practically sprinted back to the bedroom. Fortunately, our trains weren't until the middle of the day. Afterwards, Jack said, much as I hate to accept it, what you said about going on more or less as we are is the sensible thing to do. It'll be hard to sort out chances to do something like this cottage again. I think the friends who own it are planning to put an evacuated family in it, so it won't be available. Jack, I could find a wedding ring if you wanted to go to an hotel. I still had my rings. Jack looked thoughtful. Well, I could get in big trouble if I gave a false name. But if we simply showed up with our identity cards and you were wearing a ring, there's no illegality in that. In fact, my guess is that if the hotel reception notices the names aren't the same, saying there's a war on would be enough to shut them up. It isn't illegal to share hotel rooms, just the policy of some hotels, while others probably haven't had two people married to each other in the same room for years. We both laughed. We'd better get dressed, I said. Not until I've given these wonderful playthings a gentle squeeze. I'd noticed Jack was fascinated by my breasts. Sorry, they're not bigger. Both Mabel and I often use a fairly tight-fitting singlet for both warmth and to avoid having to wear a brassiere. As you've noticed, brassieres are a bit fiddly to get on and off. I don't mind taking them off, Jack said, pretending all innocence. And as for size, I think you're. You can say tits if you like. Between us. Not for general consumption. Thanks. Well, I think your tits are a nice size for your body. Overly heavy girls seem very awkward doing anything physical, but I guess some men like them big and floppy. Well, do me up. By now I had my panties on, and Jack could rehook my bra. Part 061. When we kissed goodbye, we travelled together to Bath. I couldn't stop a few tears. Jack wasn't finding it easy either. As we broke apart so I could climb into the carriage, he whispered, "Love you, Mary." "You too, Jack," I whispered back. Fortunately, the guard blew his whistle just then. Part 062. Unfortunately, we didn't see each other again for over 3 months. The farm was busy. Ministry men came nosing around saying they were considering bigger fields because they were more efficient. We gave them a cup of tea, and while they were drinking it, I said to Mabel, "Did you record yesterday's production of Plot C8? I knew she had. And she got to reply yes, in the log, and on the slip there on the board. One of the ministry men said, "You have a plan and record of the whole small holding?" "Yes. Right here on the wall," I answered. "That plot has produced £3,920 of tomatoes so far, with perhaps a sixth of the product still to come. It's about a tenth of an acre. That's a very good yield, the man seemed surprised. Mabel said yes, 15 short tons an acre is considered average according to some numbers we found thanks to the local librarian. We like to keep our yields up, but it's difficult to get manure, of course, and the lack is hurting. How about your other production? The man asked. Come and look at the slips, I suggested, and he got up and came over. Well, Joe, I think we'd be wasting time and effort to produce less than these industrious ladies are harvesting. And they've got their figures organized better than most. Besides, lots of work to fill in the ditches and get the gravel off the paths. Mabel and I gave each other a surreptitious grin. Part 063. We were now near the end of September. The summer had been busy. The WI did jam again. I was happy working outside with the crops, and my days were long and full. I wrote to Jack about twice a week. Nothing very momentous, but I told him what produce we were harvesting, minor tales of the children and their work. Oliver, now 13, had shot up a few inches. He had expanded the rabbit production, but now had to find extra food for them. Somehow he made barter arrangements around the neighborhood and assorted children would show up with sacks of material such as weeds and peelings. Some wasn't suitable for the rabbits, but Oliver was able to use most of it and I helped him build more hutches. Somehow he acquired the wire netting to do this. I think George helped him find a source, though it may have been off the books. All sorts of materials were becoming difficult to find. This year we sent some ducks to the butcher, and sold a very few duck eggs, which were considered special. Our output was so tiny it was currently outside the ration system, and we didn't give the ducks special feed. Toby was still my companion, but he now divided his loyalties between me and Matilda. I didn't mind. Reggie still took his duties seriously. One night there was a lot of barking and screeching and we came out to find Toby and Reggie had killed a fox that was trying to get at the chickens. It was a gory mess, and both Mabel and I had to praise the dogs even as we were struggling with nausea. But we didn't lose any chickens. Delia, somehow less squeamish, nailed the fox's tail to the henhouse as a sort of warning trophy. In all the summer, we saw very little of the war. It was in the news, of course, but it was difficult to decode the real situation. In August there was a lot of noise about the deep raid, but by mid-September the casualties were reported and we began to wonder what had really happened. It seemed that there was a lot of covering up of mistakes. By the time the casualty lists for Deep came out, news of a victory at El Alamein was on the wireless and in the papers. Later we found out this really was correct to the extent that Montgomery stopped the Axis from reaching Suez. A couple of months later, he really did get a true victory. Both battles, of course, killed a lot of men, but not anywhere near the same two-thirds killed or captured at Deep. At the end of August, the royal family lost the Duke of Kent when the Sunderland he was on crashed in Scotland. The war affects everyone. I was glad Jack was in the police. At least I'd have a chance to see him. Mabel's Peter had now been moved somewhere else, but it seemed still in Britain. She guessed Plymouth, and was hoping he'd get some leave. Even 48 hours would give him a chance to get home if he really was in Plymouth. Perhaps it would be better if Mabel went there, then they'd have more time together. After tea, which was late now that we didn't stop outside work until dark, I said Mabel. If Peter gets leave, why don't you go to him so you can get the benefit of his whole leave? That would mean me paying for the train, and there'd be a hotel too. If Peter comes here, he gets a travel warrant. Well, I've not spent much in the last year. How about a combined birthday and Christmas present of a fiver? Matilda spoke up, I'll do the same. With 10 quid you and Peter should be able to have a nice couple of days. Mabel temporized, it'll mean Delia and Oliver don't see him. That's true, I said, but then Oliver jumped in. Mum, I think you should, if you can, do what Mary and Grandma suggest. Don't you think so too, Delia? I would like to see Daddy, but the two of you need some time to talk and be together. Christmas was nice when he was here, but it was so busy. I don't think you had a chance to just sit and talk. Matilda responded, "That's extremely mature and generous of you, children. And I think that settles it, Mabel. Better write tonight and find out if things can be arranged." Part 064. Monday, October 5th, 1942. Matilda had made one of her wonderful rabbit stews. Good job too. We expected Mabel back mid-afternoon, but there were delays, there were always delays, on the railway, and it was well after dark when she came in. After she'd been to the lav and washed up, and given the children each a book that was a present from their father, we set a bowl of the stew, a cup of tea and a large wedge of bread, unfortunately national loaf, in front of her.
Ah,
this is so welcome. I've had nothing since about 10 this morning except a couple of biscuits and some water. Good job I took that lemonade bottle with me and filled it up. The children peppered her with questions about where she and Peter had gone. They'd found a modest hotel in Tavistock and managed to walk on Dartmoor since the weather had been dry. By dint of taking a morning bus out of Tavistock and walking back, they'd managed to get some variety of scenery. The hotel had provided breakfast and dinner, and Mabel had taken some provisions just in case, though she'd managed to bring most back again.
Waste not, want not.
The books Peter had chosen, and Mabel pointed out he'd already got them before she arrived in Plymouth, were one of Richmore Crompton's William books and a book on British wild plants and bushes. He'd written in both to Delia and Oliver. Love, Dad, October 1942. Mabel said he couldn't decide which one to give to each of you, but they're books, so you should be able to both enjoy them. Matilda said I wouldn't have thought that books about an 11-year-old tearaway would be much of interest to Delia. That Crompton fellow writes for little boys. Except Richmore Crompton is a single lady of about 50, I said. Apparently, she's volunteered for the fire service. The William books are about a young boy, but they can be read by all ages.
Oh,
I didn't know that. How odd, for a single woman to write about children, and of the other sex. About this time, I headed up to bed, and Mabel wasn't far behind me. There was a quiet knock on my door just as I was getting into bed. I opened the door and Mabel said, "Can I come in for a minute?"
Of course. Is everything all right?
As all right as things get in this war. I just wanted to say thanks. It was absolutely right for Peter and I to have a getaway. Almost a second honeymoon. I couldn't resist, and said I hope Peter came prepared.
Oh, yes.
He had plenty. Then with a smirk, she added, and we used nearly all of them. This morning I was rather sore, but in a nice way. Peter had been saving up, then? Not just him. I'd been deprived too. I just hope we didn't scandalize the other guests. The bed was a bit squeaky. Part 065. That day I'd had a letter from Jack. He was being promoted again, to inspector, and transferred to the Criminal Investigation Department, or CID. So he was now Detective Inspector Morrison. In my reply, I congratulated him. The letter also said his duties would still include special activities as needed, but probably he'd mostly be looking into criminal activity, especially black market and rationing crimes. He wrote, of course, that he wouldn't be sharing details. I told him to look after himself. There'd been some nasty characters around in London. Talking with Mabel, I realized I'd been missing Jack. A few times when working in the plots, I'd daydreamed about our weekend in Cheddar and found my knickers wet. It hadn't been like that with William. Part 066. November 11th, 1942. Jack had got a couple of days off and I'd come up to Bath. There was enough bomb damage that he'd booked us a room near Saltford, about halfway to Bristol. Bristol had had its share of bombs too. Jack had met me about 6 o'clock in Bath. Sorry to say, I'm on standby in case something develops. Let's hope it doesn't. I'll have to give the telephone number of the hotel. A bit awkward. I've told my colleagues I haven't seen my fiancé for 3 months. Got the usual wink and nudge, but I think they'll not call unless it's critical. Did you tell them my name? Some men might take me for a, you know, good time girl.
No.
Figured it's none of their business. But given some of the investigations I'm involved in, I don't want anyone thinking I'm getting some bribes or special favors from the crooks. My colleagues simply know you're working in Taunton in agriculture. The hotel was able to give us an evening meal. Not great, but could have been worse. They did have a well-stocked bar. Well-stocked by the standards of the day, anyway. We weren't going to be drinking whiskey or other spirits, but we did have a sherry before eating and beer with the meal. Even some coffee to follow, which I'd only had a couple of times before. In our room, which had a sink and some tepid water, we were rather anxious. Everything happened a bit quickly. All in about 5 minutes. That wasn't quite what I'd planned, Jack said. We were trying too hard. Let's cuddle and in a while we'll try again a bit more slowly. Yes. The cottage in Cheddar was much more conducive to that. And a good deal warmer. There's frost forecast tonight, I think. Jack pulled the eiderdown up around me. We held each other close for a while, then he said I was in London for a planning session 10 days ago. We're sharing information on gangs, since they don't stay nicely in one policing region. Is that your first time there apart from delivering the prisoner in the van? Since the start of the war, yes. I was there a couple of times on outings with my parents in the 30s. Did it seem more knocked about than before? Not sure. We've had similar here in Bath and Bristol. Not like Taunton, which has pretty much escaped so far. Did you have to stay over? Yes. We were put up in a hotel in Chelsea for a couple of nights. Actually, I had a few hours free and managed to learn that your former landlady died. I tensed up, and Jack noticed. Sorry. Perhaps I shouldn't have, but I know Mrs. Carter, I learned her name from a street directory, was a good friend. Yes, she was. Probably owe her my life. That's more or less how I view things. Anyway, I simply went to the address I'd noticed on your identity card. I knocked and said who I was, but that my visit was a personal and not a police one to find out for a friend why she'd had no letters from Mrs. Carter with whom she'd had a friendship. They told me she died of cancer in August 1941 and they were the new tenants, so didn't know much. Did you learn anything about the man next door? I was rather stiff with anxiety as I asked that. Ooh, you're all rigid. Calm down, Detective Inspector Morrison won't be arresting you. He gave me a kiss and I relaxed a little. What did you learn? I asked the woman who answered, a Mrs. Jones, which is sort of funny given you are Smith, if the neighbors might have any information about Mrs. Carter. She said that there had been a couple there, but the wife had been killed in the May 10, 1941, bombings and the widower had been asked to move to smaller lodgings by the housing authorities since he was one man in a whole house. I got his address from Mrs. Jones. The warrant card is quite helpful in loosening tongues. Unfortunately, we've also noticed some criminals forging police identity cards. With the war on, we can threaten to charge under the foreign agent rules, which puts the wind up even fairly hardened crooks, but the message hasn't fully got out yet. Jack was wandering off topic. I asked, so did you find out any more about William? Clearly Jack already knew his name, and presumably the name of his supposedly late wife. Yes. I don't think he liked being a lodger, and sweet-talked his landlady into marrying him, so he's now cock of the roost in her house. Poor woman. We can imagine what he'll do to her. I said this, and meant it, but somehow was relieved that William wasn't likely to want me to reappear in my old identity. My thoughts nearly had me miss what Jack was saying. Actually, William may treat her rather carefully. His new wife has a brother whose name I've seen in the files. William should have done his homework. Brother Tom is the type of person who can make someone turn into a corpse floating in the Thames. I'll possibly have to keep an eye out in case the new brother-in-law should lean on William to give information useful in a bank robbery or something similar. Jack. Thank you for looking into things. Well, I want us to be able to have a future, and if your former neighbor, as she will continue to be, is allowed to rest in peace, that future is brighter. I pondered what Jack had said, then asked to change the subject a little. What was in your mind when you told your colleagues I was your fiancé? Would a good answer be wishful thinking? I think early warning might be better. What? Meaning I'd be happy for it to be true, and we could agree that I'm your fiancé whenever you are ready. I got a kiss for that, and some gentle manhandling of my breasts, then between my legs, where I could tell things were very slippery. Should I get a towel for you to lie on? Jack asked, and I nodded. He slid out of bed so he wouldn't push the covers back, grabbed a towel from the rack beside the sink, and rushed back under the covers. We fumbled around under these to get me onto the towel, then Jack was playing with me again. That feels really nice at the front of my slit. I can tell. I didn't think detectives used truncheons. And this one has some extra bits. Mary. You are wicked, but none of your wickedness falls under chargeable offenses. Unless, of course, I don't get a rubber on and find a warm place to put my truncheon. Part 067. We were mostly lucky with our couple of days, but there was a telephone call early on the 13th. We'd managed a bit of walking on the 12th, and a bit of daydreaming about what life might be like when the war ended. We talked about whether getting married sooner would work, but the likely outcome would be that I'd be back in the pool for national service, and then possibly sent somewhere else. The farm was a good situation for me, and it offered a bit of stability, even for Jack. I'd worn the wedding ring I had. That was for the benefit of the hotel. I wondered about the engagement ring I already had. Jack said he'd save up for a new one, and I said I'd rather he saved up for a nice house and furniture and pots and pans and dishes. He got the idea, and agreed that building a life together was more important than a bit of jewelry. I was thinking that it would be nice to be married, but not nice to be apart. The war was only recently looking more favorable to our side. This year had started gravely with the Japanese onslaught. And the U-boats were still sinking lots of ships and threatening to starve us to death. We sat on a bench and Jack put his arm round me. It was cool but, though some rain threatened, had stayed dry. Jack. What do you think we should do with the engagement ring? And the wedding ring, I suppose? Jack told me the name of a jeweler in Taunton who he trusted, and said it would be worth getting it appraised, even if that cost a shilling or two. Tell him it belonged to your mother or a family member if he asks, Jack said. Then you'll know if it's worth anything. If it is worth something, we'll think how to use the value sensibly. However, we don't want any suspicions it's looted. Apparently looters were fighting each other to steal jewelry off the dead Café de Paris patrons when it got bombed, and the rescue services couldn't get through to help the injured, who I'm guessing were also being robbed. Makes me sick. I can see why looters can be summarily shot, though the courts haven't imposed the death penalty yet for looting. Yes. Better to just put the ring away or throw it away than get into a spot of bother because of it. I was almost ready to throw it away now. I can afford a new wedding ring for you, Jack said. And Mary Smith should have her own, right? Of course she should, I agreed, and gave him a kiss on the cheek. But how soon? I want like blazes to be married to you, but don't want to be traipsing round, living in dismal rented rooms until the war's over and we can get settled. Well, I can't see that it makes sense to leave the farm. I know you are happy there, both with the people and, unless I'm totally wrong in my observations, you find the work rewarding. Yes. I do enjoy the work, even though it's quite long hours a lot of the time and physically demanding. And I feel part of the family. It's what I hope we can build eventually. Even if my career's in the police, I can't see that you shouldn't find something like that. But do be aware that when Peter comes back, your role would change. I'd hate for you to come a cropper emotionally because you weren't prepared for things to change. But you and I could find somewhere that would allow you to grow things. My guess is that even when war ends, there'll be shortages for a while. We've a hell of a lot of rebuilding to do, and no money in the government coffers. You sound a bit despondent about that, I said. Not really. It'll be a challenge, that's all. And a lot of people will expect that everything will suddenly be all right and wonderful, but of course it won't. It's the disappointment that might be worse than the reality. Let's hope not for us. I agree, Mary. And it's one reason why I'm happy you want like blazes to be married to me. So what should we do? Do you want to get married as soon as possible? Quietly, but so when we are able to be together, we don't have to worry about appearances. Yes, even in wartime, we have to keep up appearances. Especially a police inspector. Jack said this with a tinge of irony in his voice. I could go and see the vicar in Taunton at St. James where the WI meets in the hall. I could find out when we could get married. Though I'm not a regular at services. In fact, hardly at all, though I'm usually at the hall for the WI on Sunday afternoons. Why don't I write a letter to the register office? It's in the municipal building, so you have my agreement that we want to marry. I can include my police address and telephone if they need it, as well as my lodgings address and birthdate and birthplace. But since I was a bobby there, someone in the office will know me. Somewhere I read we need to give notice of at least 29 days. I think that means that if we give notice tomorrow, Friday the 13th of November, the earliest we can marry would be the 42nd of November, known as the 12th of December, which is Saturday. But maybe they insist on one more day, so Sunday 13th would be the earliest date. And I may have to give notice at the register office in Bath, since that's where I lodge now. You're in a real hurry, Jack. No. Just working out the earliest date to see when it falls. But clearly, we can get married before the end of the year. Unfortunately, since I had Christmas off last year, I'm on duty this year. Thursday 24th to Monday morning following. Perhaps we could get married on New Year's Day. That might be a nice time, I said. Yes. Will you have time to get a wedding dress? I think I'd prefer something different. I've, seen all the fuss about the white dress, and it's a lot of work for something you get to wear for a few hours. I think I'd like a nice costume that would do for dressing up for a number of years. Some of the CC-41 utility costumes were horrid, though the ones that actress Deborah Kerr modeled were really nice in appearance. The other day I saw a nice one in a shop that I quite liked, and it had a CC-41 label. I've spent almost none of my coupons, so I think I could get a complete outfit, including a coat, a blouse, and some undies, though I'd likely then not have any coupons left. Still, I think it would be worth it. Mabel and I have also been trying to find out if we qualify for a work clothing allowance. If we had some points for overalls, they'd give Mabel some flexibility for the children's clothing. We can get dungarees without points if we don't get the extra coupons, but not the best types. And we can get blackout material without coupons. Some people sew items from that. Someone in the WI was able to get material from a German parachute. I don't know if from an airman or a mine that didn't go off. Well, as a man, I don't expect to get a word in edgewise when you're enthused about women's clothing, but I will say I think that a well-fitted suit of skirt and jacket would be very appropriate to a wartime wedding. And you've not got a coat that's not really workwear. Would you wear a suit, or a police uniform? I probably would look better in uniform, but once we have a date, I'll write to the chief constable and ask permission to wear it so nobody can complain. I actually hadn't thought about it, but it makes some sense. You know, it'll be a lot easier visiting your family if we're married, I said. Or when I come to Taunton. But we'll have to learn to fit in a single bed. I can think of worse problems, I laughed, and got a kiss for my levity. Then Jack turned a little serious and said, "It occurs to me that there are quite a lot of people like yourself who were bombed out and lost everything, including documents. It's plain that there'll be mistakes in the records, and no doubt some people will find they've been declared dead by mistake." "You think that might happen to me?" I asked, guessing that he wanted to tell me something. "Possibly. Never know when someone sets up a memorial for people killed in a raid and then someone else notices that one of the victims has been married later on. That sort of thing. I'm sure something like that could happen. Or people are similar in appearance to someone who died. There could be unhappy encounters of the sort I thought you were dead with strangers." Carefully and tentatively, I said, "Do you think there'd be a lot of trouble in such cases, or just some temporary awkwardness?" "Probably depends. In your situation, having been bombed twice, and injured, remember how your face was when we met, there's still tiny marks if I look very, very closely, it would be remarkable if there wasn't some confusion in the records. Is there anything I should do to make sure my situation is all right?" "You've got your documents and identity card. There's probably some confusion about ration cards for early 1941. You were recovering from one bombing and then got blown about by another. I think the main thing is not to get in a flap should there be anything come up. You are clearly alive, and you have been living and working in Taunton since escaping the bombing. There have been some fiddles with false claims for compensation and benefits to bomb victims, ration cards, and so on. I'm sure there's other rackets being tried. But you haven't been involved in anything like trying to use an old and a new ration card at the same time. Just the opposite, you somehow managed without. So best to be polite but firm that you're who you say you are. Say as little as possible, because it's only likely to give people red herrings to make a fuss about. If there's some official request for information, I'd get a solicitor to advise on how to reply, for example, to correct information that says you're dead." Jack knew my real name, of course, but I understood that it was important to him that he never acknowledged that he knew. That he could never be accused of addressing me in a way that showed he knew. That made a lot of sense, and it helped me be Mary Smith. Jack was giving me excellent advice, and from the viewpoint of a fairly senior police officer. Probably violating several policies and undertakings. "How would I find a solicitor?" I asked. "I know one or two from my work, of course. Actually, it would make sense for us to both make our wills. We don't have much now, but having them gives clarity and helps later. I've known of cases where people didn't have a will and there were court cases over disputed rights. Also, if we're married, you'd qualify for some benefits if anything happened to me. I'll write to you with a couple of names and addresses. Have to look them up. That way we'll take care of the future and we'll have the contact if we ever need it for other things, even buying a house. Yes, it would be nice to have our own house." I meant what I said about a house, but also wanted to bring this thread of conversation to a close. It made me anxious, both from the point of view of my identity and because Jack was talking about benefits if he were killed. On the other hand, I knew Jack was trying to give me some direction in how to handle what could bring disaster upon us. There could be people who knew the old me. Someone might recognize me despite my change in hair and the fact I'd become more muscular with my work. It wasn't out of the question. "Just have to say sorry. Do I know you? And oh, There must be someone out there looks like me. If the record of Joan Mary Smith being blown to unrecognizable pieces was raised, Jack's advice to get a solicitor involved was good. My story of being twice involved with bombs, plus some injuries noted by Jack as a policeman, Mrs. Hodges and Mrs. Appleby at the rest center, and Maud Brown and Jackie Hazelton at the WI, would allow me to argue that I had trouble remembering exact details. There were plenty of cases of people not quite right after being blown about by bombs. Jack was telling me to provide no details that could be checked and challenged. The most awkward situation, and one he didn't mention, was if Joan Smith had friends or acquaintances who somehow encountered me. "You're not like the Joan Smith I remember. But I used Mary Smith, soon to be Mary Morrison, if I got my identity card changed. Yes. I should do that. Was there anything else I had to do?" Well, I had made a note of the names of the people at the rest center and its location. And I actually still had the old label with the map to Paddington. They were in my footlocker. Part 068. I stopped by the municipal buildings on my way home from the station when I got back to Taunton. It wasn't much out of my way in any case. Friday, January 1st, 1943 had an opening in the late morning, and I asked if I could book that and register our intent to marry. I passed Jack's letter to the lady who was at the desk.
"Oh. You lucky girl. I met Jack a couple of times when he was on the beat here. Lovely man. And now detective inspector. Good for him. And you, of course."
While the lady was quite helpful in telling me what Jack needed to do so that we had all the correct procedures followed, she seemed a lot more interested in how he was doing, where we planned to live, and how the farm was doing, since she knew Mabel and Peter by acquaintance. Still, it was good to have a friendly and interested official rather than a coldly bureaucratic one. Mabel and Matilda were excited by my news, and both said they would come with me on Monday. We didn't want to try shopping for clothing on the Saturday, to try to find an appropriate outfit. I was somewhat anxious beforehand that they would argue for the white dress, but both had been struggling to figure out how to dress themselves and the children on the limited points. There was enough clothing for now, but the children were growing and work pants and other items took a lot of wear and tear out in the fields. Over our tea, there was quite a discussion about how quiet our quiet wedding would be. Mabel assured me the WI members would insist on a bit of celebration, if only for an hour or so. I realized as they were talking about this that Jack's family would want to come. I included a question about that when I wrote to Jack that evening. Part 069. In a sense, William got the last laugh about the engagement ring. The jeweler didn't even charge to tell me the ring was paste. "Looks good from a distance, but won't stand a close-up view. Glass in place of diamond, and a plated metal ring. Not a bad appearance, but my guess is this is a theatre prop. Sorry, love." Fortunately, I'd said nothing to the man except that Jack had recommended him as an honest dealer and that I wanted to know the value of a ring. I thanked him, and wondered why he seemed to be expecting me to say or do something, then realized that he suspected I'd been given the ring to hasten a seduction. I said archly I should have known he was a fraud, which was, of course, true. The jeweler seemed satisfied with that response. I'd gone to the jeweler first on Monday. That would be November 16th. Matilda and Mabel were doing some shopping and would meet me at the clothing shop where I'd seen the CC41 utility costume I liked. I got there a quarter hour before them and had learned that, much to my disappointment, the item I found interesting was well outside my size. By the time Mabel and Matilda arrived, I'd found two costumes that fitted me. I wasn't thrilled by either. In any event, I tried each on. Unfortunately, with my heavy lisle stockings, which did no favors to the overall appearance, and my friends confirmed my verdict. The shop owner said, "Wait a minute. I have a suit that was going to go to, well, one of my other customers. I said I'd hold it until last Saturday, but she didn't pick it up. Just before you came in, her mother telephoned to say she got called up for the WAACs and won't need it.
Let me see if you like it and it fits. We were lucky. It was close to the model and fabric I'd first found attractive in the window, and it fitted me very well. In fact, no adjustments would be needed. I'd already seen a coat I liked. It was a nice tweed one and would last a long time if I took care of it. I'd now been in the shop 3/4 of an hour, and thought we'd be out in another few minutes. However, choosing underwear and a blouse took another hour. Actually, it wasn't the choice of garment, it was the juggling of the points, so I got a new pair of stockings, still Lyle but of a better quality, cami knickers, panties, blouse, along with the costume and coat. In the end, Matilda saved the day by lending me a coupon. I could pay her back when we got our new allocation. Fortunately, I'd got a pair of decent enough shoes just before rationing of clothing came in. They were low-heeled but quite suitable for nearly all occasions, and I'd never been comfortable with high heels. Mabel had had the foresight to stock up on Dubbin, and at the farm we were all fiends when it came to keeping leather well protected. Since clogs, the English rather than Dutch kind, were available without coupons, we'd been wearing those when we could, which was much of the time. Our feet got used to the wooden soles, and they weren't uncomfortable for outdoor work, though not appropriate for walking any distance. We also had Wellingtons, though I was using Peters. Sometimes they were available. Points needed, of course.